Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
All right, good morning. Welcome to the Los Angeles Public Library. It's a pleasure to welcome you, all of you, to our Allowed Business Forum. We're delighted to be joined by guests of our sponsors, Union Bank, our breakfast sponsor, Wachovia, our season presenting sponsor, the law firm Aaron Fox, and KPMG. What you saw on the screen earlier was video from one of our earlier forums. You can watch video of any of our forums on the website fora.tv, F-O-R-A.tv. Since the beginning of the year, 48,000 people have viewed our videos, which is encouraging, that multiplier effect. Special welcome to our newest season sponsor, the Pearson Foundation, which makes it possible for us to host students. Today we have students from the Drucker School and from UCLA. Welcome. Just a little reminder on housekeeping. Please turn off your cell phones, pagers, anything else that might ring. If you drove, parking is $8. Just go to the P1 window, let them know you are here, and you get the benefit of the reduced rate. The Allowed Business Forum is an extension of our award-winning evening program now in its 15th year. Here we feature prominent business leaders, big thinkers and authors, especially focusing on leadership, innovation, and entrepreneurship. With the Business Forum, we strive to feature what's timely, what's compelling, what's in the news, what's current, and give the Los Angeles business community an ideal meeting place and a great venue for that marketplace of ideas. My name is Ted Haptegaber. I'm Director of Corporate Relations at the Library Foundation. What we do at the Library Foundation is raise funds to benefit the Los Angeles Public Library. If you're one of our donors or of an associate, we appreciate all your support. Your investment in the library has an impact all over this city. And in the current economic climate, the demand for library services is greater than ever. Many of you walk through the library, taking a shortcut to the other side of town. Some of you walk around us when the library is not open. My hope is that the Business Forum is an excuse for you to stop in and spend some time with us. To learn more about the foundation, please visit one of my colleagues on your way out or pick up our Aware magazine that tells you about some of our activities. And over time, I hope we can count you too as one of our friends and donors. We have a little something special coming at the end of the year. It's our signature event. It's our annual gala. It's that celebration of the written word and celebration of philanthropy. It's a large contribution to what makes the Library Foundation move. This year we honor Tom Brokaw as a writer, Veronique Peck, who's tirelessly put the Gregory Peck reading series together, also now in its 15th year. And our corporate honoree this year is Union Bank. So it's a pleasure to have all you Union Bank people here to thank you for your support. And the rest of you can be part of that. On the way out, I have some envelopes. If you want to join us at dinner, we'd very much like you to be there. It would thrill me to see a table or two or three of Business Forum patrons. I want to thank Wachovia as our presenting sponsor. We honored Wachovia last year at this dinner. Their support is what made this Business Forum possible. Many thanks also to KPMG and the law firm of Aaron Fox, who are year-long sponsors, and I mentioned earlier the Pearson Foundation. You may purchase Nandan Nalekani's book after the program, and he'll happily sign them for a little bit. As an individual subscriber of the Business Forum, when we feature an author, the book is included in your subscription, as is the parking. So feel free to speak to me after the program, and I'll sign you up for that, too. Our next speaker is April 21st. I've said April is International Month here. We feature Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. She's the founder of the Green Belt Movement. That's April 21st. There's a documentary based on her that airs on PBS on April 14th. It is my pleasure to welcome Vijay Sathe, who is a professor of management at the Drucker School of Management. Prior to joining the Drucker School, he was a professor at Harvard. For 10 years, he's taught in executive education programs all over the world. He's a consultant to corporations, author of numerous professional publications. His latest book is Corporate Entrepreneurship, Top Managers, and New Business Creation. The Drucker School is one of our strategic partners. It's a pleasure to be working with them. Ira Jackson, I see at the back of the room. Thanks for coming. On the anniversary of the centennial of Peter Drucker's birth, we have this special partnership where we've had Ira host some of our events, and today Vijay, and hopefully a couple more before the year is over. To introduce our featured speaker today, please welcome Phil Flynn. Phil is the COO of Union Bank. Phil is a member of our board of directors at the Library Foundation. Phil is our breakfast sponsor, and Phil will represent Union Bank when we award them later this year. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Ted. Good morning, and on behalf of Union Bank, it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you here today. Fostering and promoting educational activities are core values of our company. So we're very glad to be part of the Allowed Business Forum. As a member of the board of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, I'm also proud to personally support today's program. Last fall, a group of us from the bank had the privilege of visiting Bangalore to meet today's speaker, the co-founder, former CEO, and current co-chairman of Infosys, Nandan Nilekani. Union Bank and Infosys have recently entered into an agreement to replace our entire core banking platform over the next 4 years. This is the largest technology investment our company's ever made by far. And when it's complete, it will put us at the forefront of U.S. banks from a technology point of view. Our willingness to make this huge investment has much to do with the amazing capabilities of Infosys. And Nandan, of course, deserves much of the credit for the creation of that world-class company. But Nandan is more than a business executive. His ability to envision the future and explain it to laymen is amply illustrated in his new book, Imagining India, which many of you now have. Tom Friedman, the author of the foreword to Nandan's book, credits him with being the inspiration for writing his own bestseller, The World is Flat. Friedman points to Nandan's observation that the playing field was being leveled by technology and that ultimately this transformation would loop back and transform India as well. In his book, Nandan describes the ebb and flow of ideas over time in India and the consequent impact on the economy and politics. I was intrigued by the proposition that India's enormous population, long thought to be a hindrance to the country's development and advancement, is now becoming an important resource. To quote a few statistics from the book, with a median age of only 23, India has the second largest reservoir of skilled labor in the world. India produces 2 million English-speaking graduates a year, 15,000 law graduates, 9,000 PhDs. There's an existing pool of 2.1 million engineering graduates, which increases by 300,000 every year. Pretty amazing statistics. With these resources and human capital, India should be expected to be on the same playing field as other major powers in the world. However, as Nandan points out, the country is hampered by the relative youth of its democratic processes and the continued conflicts between caste, class, regional, and religious interests. I want to set the stage properly for our guest today. The New York Times review of the book, quoting Friedman, points out that there are only a handful of executives around the world who are known by their first names. Steve is in Jobs, Bill is in Gates, and Warren is in Buffett. In India, it's Nandan, as in Nilekani. His vision of modern India not only does a great job of explaining the present, but also anticipates a future in which those vast resources help bring the country into the 21st century. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming our very special guest, Nandan Nilekani.
Thank you, Phil. It's my distinct honor to have a chance to talk to you, Nandan.
Thanks, Vijay.
I'd like to begin with a little audience participation. How many of you have already read the book? And there's some books that between 8 a.m. and this time, it's already read. Well, this is not one of those. And luckily for me, I found out that the Indian edition was released late last year. And so I had a friend pick up a copy for me and began reading it over the holidays, and I'm glad I did. because I was hooked, and it took a while to get through it. So I'd like to just say a couple of prefacing words and get into the question. It's an amazing tour de force in terms of the number of issues you cover, all the way from poverty to education to politics to history to you name it. And the other thing that really surprised me is that, you know, usually you take a business book and the book is chapter one, and you're basically done, and the rest of the book is so that you can have a book. You know, I thought, okay, this will take about a week and I'll be done. But I was hooked because every chapter is different. So anyone planning to read this book, plan on some time, some lovely time to do it. But I was hooked in the book. And, you know, the thing that intrigued me, among other things, is that rather than being a memoir, you went and talked to 100 interesting people, at least, from various walks of life, not just technologists, but politicians and you name it. So it's an amazing undertaking, and I really want to compliment you on that.
Thanks.
The first question is, why did you write it?
Well, you know, that's a question everybody asked me, and I think they wanted to watch this business guy writing books on India. Well, there were a number of reasons, Vijay. One was that, over the last several years, I've been going around the world, and while I've been talking to Infosys, I've also been some kind of an unofficial ambassador for India in many global forums. And everywhere they would ask me questions about India which I could not reply. They would ask me, why is it that you have so many billionaires on one side in the Forbes list and so many poor people? Why is it that your campus is so beautiful and the city has so many slums? Why is it that parts of India are in the 17th century, parts in the 21st century? Why is it that you have such a big outsourcing industry with high technology capability and the world's largest pool of young, uneducated children? So, you know, when you try to explain these contradictions, I used to be flummoxed. I couldn't really give very convincing answers. And I felt I must go back and check out, you know, what is the reality? Why is it the way it is? You know, and I thought maybe I could learn from myself and also explain that to the world. So that was one motivation. The second motivation was that I felt India's window of opportunity was tightening, that there was a small window when it really had a chance to do something for the future. But it was a very short window, and I didn't sense the sense of urgency that you would associate with something like that. And I thought in the Indian conversation had become very tactical and very one-dimensional, as opposed to strategic and long-term. So I just thought I'll put my hat in the ring with this book.
I wonder if you would share a secret third reason I was wondering that might be behind the book. And that is that I've seen too many CEOs who become chairmen, but they still behave like CEOs.
Yeah, I've said that in my book, that this is the most benign manifestation of a post-CEO midlife crisis. It's a way of keeping myself, you know,
out of the way. Keep your hands out of the way. It's pretty smart. So, you know, given the motivation of the book, it's impossible to summarize this book, and I'll get into some specifics.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is there an overall point of view to the book?
Yeah, I think when you write a book on India, you know, one thing is that people typically take a point of view. An economist will write about the economics of India. A sociologist will write about its society and caste system. A political scientist will write about the politics. And I felt that none of them would do justice to such a vast and comprehensive and complex topic. So I decided that I'll do everything. You know, clearly there's no shortage of ambition in this stuff. And I said, since I don't know all this, I took out my Rolodex. Around the last two decades, I met so many interesting people, and I started calling them and interviewing them for the book. And I interviewed, as you said, over 125 people for this book, which I then assembled together. So that was one part. I wanted to give a much more holistic view of India rather than a very parochial or a very narrow, disciplined view of India. The second thing is that people write books on India which are about events, but then they end up becoming histories. Or they write about important people, and then they end up becoming biographies. I thought that it is important to explain India through the medium of ideas. And because I think, like the US, India is a country founded on ideas, founded on ideals. And most of our time is trying to live up to those ideals. And it's only when ideas change that change happens. You know, it's only when a new thing is accepted that change happens. It doesn't happen because somebody issues a fatwa or a diktat saying this must happen. It happens because people start believing in something. So I thought looking at it through ideas was a good way of looking at India. And also the idea framework allowed me to look at the past, the current, and the future. Because it was not just about a book about what has happened. It's also a book about what can happen in the future. So I had to project into the future. So really, the ideas is the big, the theme of the whole thing.
So getting into the details a little bit, as Phil was mentioning, there are these well-known divides. When I first came to this country 40 years ago, that's what you heard about, is all the poverty and all the basically lack of knowledge about India. But now people do realize these big vertical cracks, as you call them, between caste and class and poverty and so on. And I read you talking about horizontal integrating forces, mm-hmm. like globalization, like English, and so on. Can you?
Well, you know, I guess this is, it happens if you have a degree in electrical engineering or something. You start thinking of these things in structured ways. So I felt that there were a set of things which were dividing the country, and I call them the vertical dividers. For example, religion. You know, India has all possible religions, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Jainism, Judaism, the works. And it has the world's second largest Muslim population. So it's a very complex and diverse country. And that's often been utilized or manipulated by political forces to create division among the people. Or we have this whole caste system, which, you know, most people say is the most sophisticated form of social exclusion invented by mankind. A very, very complex way of excluding people. And that divides India a lot. Then there's the whole North-South divide. North India, which is lagging behind South India in development and so forth. Then there's the urban-rural, the city dwellers and the farmers. And there's the rich-poor. You know, there's so many ways you can divide India. And a politics has become the language of this division. So if you're a political entrepreneur who wants to rise in politics, you choose one of these parties and make them disaffected and, you know, become their champion. Whereas I felt when I talked to people and moved around, I found that was not what really took them. They were concerned about improving their lives, getting better education, getting better health, getting better jobs, getting their children to school. So that's why I say that either India can choose to be divided by its vertical divisions or choose to be united by its horizontal aspirations. So I thought this book is really about those horizontal aspirations.
The other theme I saw in the book, I don't know if you agree, seems to be throughout the book sort of a faith in the market and in local control on the one hand, and given the history, as you point out, the subsidies and the central control on the other hand. How is that?
Well, I think, you know, the challenge we have in India is very similar to what we have in the U.S. today. I think the U.S. also, after many decades of fairly unbridled market forces, is now thinking or trying to veer back to a model where there's more regulation. And I think most countries face this challenge of finding the right mix between markets and the state. I mean, obviously, we need the markets, and I'm a strong believer in markets to drive innovation, you know, enterprise, new products, new services, create jobs. At the same time, you need to run those markets and companies within a framework of the state in a playpen so that the rules of society are followed. And I think India is trying to find the balance between that. And I make the argument that we run two parallel systems. We run a market system, and we run this whole subsidy system. And then the conflict is between the two. And therefore, there's a way to integrate both together by bringing the subsidy system into the market. Then we can align both the economic and social goals.
One of the things that struck me is that you said in the early days after independence, people like Jawaharlal Nehru were in fact leaders, political leaders, that allowed a country that was not really yet ready for liberal democracy to plant those seeds.
Oh, yeah. No, I think Indian democracy is the most fascinating example of democracy in the world, because when Western democracies matured, they matured over hundreds of years. I mean, it took hundreds of years to give full democracy in the UK. Even in the US, I mean, if you trace the history, you know, you had the War of Independence in 1776, but you still had slavery, and then you had the 1865 Civil War between North and South on the whole issue of slavery. Then you had women's vote only in the 1920s, and you had full civil rights only after the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So it took close to 200 years to really mature fully. India gave that in one day. In one day, everybody had the full right to vote, which is a remarkably, you know, idealistic and ambitious thing to do. And I think part of the reason was that having lived for 200 years under the British imperial yoke, people felt that the only way we can be permanently free is by giving the freedom to people, you know, let them decide their rulers. And that was the whole psychology behind it. But when you give full freedom to vote in a poor country with high illiteracy, often there are unintended consequences. And therefore, a lot of the politics of India, which you see, which is the identity politics and caste-based parties and regional-based parties, all arose because of this. So, you know, but I still, net-net, I still believe that Indian democracy is a hugely positive thing.
Interesting. So before we segue into some specifics that are quite interesting, I think you're saying that today's politicians, as opposed to 40 years ago, sort of the people are ahead of the politicians.
Yes, the point I make is that in 1947, you had a bunch of leaders who were really visionaries, very similar like the founding fathers of the U.S., Jefferson, you know, Washington, and all that. So people like Gandhi, Nehru, they had a 100-year view of where India should be, and they gave this democracy. They went around the world and studied all the constitutions and designed a great constitution. They designed parliament. They designed everything. They actually created a nation. It was a work in process. So they had a long vision of where to go. I think, unfortunately, today's politics has become so tactical and so much about survival that nobody has the time to think long term. Whereas the people have actually become so much more self-confident that they're thinking about the future. So I felt that 60 years back, the leaders were ahead of the people and the people trusted them. Now it's the other way around.
So it sounds to me like the last politician who really got it seems to be Rajiv Gandhi. I didn't realize till I read.
I think Rajiv Gandhi had a huge role. I think he had a very modern view of where India should be. He was technically very savvy. In fact, he was more savvy than his bureaucrats because he knew how to operate computers, and he had worked with Sam Pitroda, whose daughter is here, on the technology, IT, and communication revolution. He was a strong believer in local self-government. So he had a lot of very, very progressive ideas that were cut short.
So I'd like to get into some of the fascinating details. And the first set of questions I thought would be on the poor. One of the most encouraging things I found in your book is the way you describe what is going on with the poor in India. And there are two, three questions I have. But the first one is, it seems to me that even though there is still a high level of illiteracy, do I read you correctly that actually the folks in the trenches are quite comfortable with trying out new technology, it sounds like, that technology kiosks, I'm not sure everyone is familiar.
I think one of the important points I make in this book is how technology in India has gone from being seen as something intimidating to something empowering. And we see that, for example, 40 years back, computers in India were called as job-eating machines, and they were banned from being imported. And even as late as the 80s, when the banking sector wanted to automate the banks, they came out with a report, except they didn't call it computerization. They called it implementation of ledger posting machines, in the belief that the unions would somehow not realize that these were computers. And when they wanted more powerful computers, they called them advanced ledger posting machines. So as late as the 80s, we were in denial about technology. But today we live in a world where there are 8 million mobile phones a month being sold, where average mobile phone, 99% of mobile phone buyers are prepaid, which means they don't even have a credit history. And 40% of those mobile phones, the average recharge is 20 cents. So they buy every day a few minutes to talk to people. So it's an amazing thing. And there are many examples. For example, the railway reservation was a good example where people learned how to go up to a counter and buy a ticket. So there was no corruption in that. So technology actually made it more accessible to the poor to access public services. Or the example I gave about land records, where you can get the land record by going to a kiosk. You just pay 15 rupees and you get the certificate. So the poor have actually found that technology is making them get a fairer deal than when they had to go through a bureaucracy. So it's become a very positive force.
One of the not so happy things I think I read in the book, you're describing reality. And I think some of the others who have interviewed you talk about the fact that you're an optimist, but you're a realistic optimist. I was kind of intrigued that the very poor people who don't even have maybe enough for themselves, because they're so dissatisfied with government education, government health, they're actually sending kids to private schools?
I think the failure of public services, both public health and public education, is one of the huge problems of India. Because today in urban India, among the poor, more than 50% of children, these are poor children, go to private schools. Now, these are not fancy private schools. These are one-room tenements, mom-and-pop operation, a couple, often with no license to operate. And even in health, 8 out of 10 rupees spent in Indian health is private money. It's not public funding. So because the state has failed in delivering good public education and public health, the people have taken matters in their own hands. And we really need to address that. And you know, for the poor to send their child to a private school is a hugely expensive proposition because the significant part of the income is going. But it shows their faith that if their children get educated, they'll have a better life. I mean, that's the big switch,
right,
that people have realized that education has a huge economic cost.
And they're even insisting on English education?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think one of the big things in India is how English evolved, and I've talked about that. I think, you know, English came to India because of outsourcing. It did. You may wonder what is this outsourcing, but what happened was in the 1830s, when the British East India Company was trying to run this country, it was getting very expensive for them to bring in British expatriates to work in India. So they decided they'll teach the locals English so they can work for them. And they taught them English, but the only thing is that it had a couple of unexpected consequences. First, it became a language for pan-Indian unity, because a Maharashtrian in Maharashtra could talk to a Bengali using English as a common language. And second, when they learned English, they learned Western ideas, liberty, fraternity, equality, all this stuff. And then they said, why don't you give that to us too? You know? So when they learned those ideas of the Renaissance, you know, this whole modern ideas, they used that to fight for independence. But when they got independence, they couldn't keep English because it sounded silly to have a imperial language as your language. So they wanted to remove Hindi. But there are a lot of Indians who didn't speak Hindi who said, if you make Hindi a national language, right, then we'll be at a disadvantage. So they insisted that English remain. And then there were a lot of fights on this. And finally, English sort of had this uneasy coexistence. And now again, thanks to the globalization, outsourcing, English has now become a language of aspiration. Right. So it's gone through this very tortuous journey. But today, everybody wants to learn English.
So one more question on the poor. People may be aware, but one of the biggest slums in Asia is at Dharavi in Mumbai. And I've been through Dharavi enough times to have smelt it very well. The fascinating thing to me was you say there are like 15,000 single-unit entrepreneurial shops and an output of $1.5 billion?
Yeah, yeah. These places are beehives of economic activity and, you know, the huge recycling, huge amount of leather work. I mean, it's extraordinary in spite of those circumstances with such poor infrastructure. And that's the basic point I make, that, you know, there's this huge entrepreneurial drive in the people which requires a much better state to provide them those basic things. And that's what we need to encourage, which is to give people a chance, but deliver the basic public service as well.
So when you talk about entrepreneurship, it's not just people like you.
No.
But the millions on the streets who are...
India has the world's largest entrepreneurs because every farmer is an entrepreneur. You know, he's completely at the mercy of prices, weather, soil, rain. He's got more risk than a venture capitalist has here. And every woman running a small vegetable cart is an entrepreneur because every morning she doesn't know what price she's going to buy the vegetables from the wholesaler. She doesn't know what price she's going to sell it to the customer. So every day is a roll of the dice.
Also very encouraging were some bureaucratic entrepreneurs. I mean, when a bureaucrat decides to do something, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think so. I've given many... I've met a lot of very enterprising bureaucrats who sort of... They're within the system, but want to make change happen, and they push and make it happen. There are many, many great examples of that.
So another audience participation. How many of you have seen Slumdog Millionaire? What do you think of the movie?
Well, I mean, it was probably very entertaining, so that's why it got the Oscars. But I think it's a little one-dimensional. I mean, I think it's a very very shallow characterization of what's happening. I think certainly India has a lot of what's in the movie, but it also has a lot of other things. And I think to really appreciate the nuances, you have to have a far more holistic view of India, which I've tried to do in the book.
Right.
I'm hoping that everybody who sees the movie also reads the book. To tell the Oscar guys to, you know, do something.
Yeah. My friends in India say this is less like a regular Hindi movie, except it's in English.
Yeah, yeah.
Moving on to some other stuff, I thought there were some really bold proposals. And I'm not even sure if any of them have been tried, but one that really intrigued me, the audience may not realize, but I didn't, many of the things in the book. But India is a $1 trillion economy. And if you take purchase price parity, PPP, it's like 3 million. And the US economy was 11 million.
15.
Maybe it's 10.4 or something now. But about 10 times bigger in nominal terms. So, you know, you have a pretty big economy, and I was amazed to learn that $200 billion of that is really going to subsidies of all kinds. A lot of that money sucked away by intermediaries, corruption, and so on, with politicians like Rajiv Gandhi saying only 5% make it to the population. And I was fascinated with your ideas. I hope you'll talk to the audience about citizen ID and...
Yeah, because I'm a technology guy.
Right.
I find it, maybe I find it at least like that, you know, for every solution you think the hammer is the right thing. I think in my mind, every solution, technology is the right thing. So basically argue that we have this massive subsidy structure, which is what you talked about, and it's not reaching the people. It's being taken away in between by producers, or it's diverted and so forth. And rather than have this indirect subsidy method, you can give direct benefits. And today's technology allows you to identify people, and you know, you can have a way to give to them directly. Everybody can have a bank account, which will help our customers like Union Bank to have bank accounts. And you can directly give money into the person's account. You know, you don't have to do all these complicated gyrations. And but that one shift from subsidies to direct benefits will have a huge impact. It'll improve everything, because today all our subsidies are for food, for fuel, and for fertilizer. And all these three, apart from not reaching the right people, are hugely environmentally unsustainable. Because you keep the price of oil low, more oil gets consumed. Because you keep the price of fertilizer low, more unsustainable fertilizer used in the fields, and so on and so forth. So you have many, many social and other benefits just by doing that one big switch. But it's a big switch, because it means dealing with huge incumbent interests who will fight you when you try to do this.
And just to get a point of comparison, right now, how many people have bank accounts in India?
Oh, it would be hardly maybe 20%.
Yeah, so it's a massive... Has any country... I mean, this is a fascinating idea, how you bypass all the potential siphoning off. Has any country or any jurisdiction done this?
No, I think there's a lot of work done in Latin America. You know, for example, if you go to Brazil and Mexico and all that, they have this whole concept of cash transfers and... conditional cash transfers. For example, women get money into their account if the children go to school and stuff like that. So they actually use it as an incentive for you to do the right social thing. So it is implemented. I don't know how well and scale, but certainly there are examples of this in Brazil and Mexico.
So in India, is anybody taking this idea forward? Is there some kind of a task force?
Yeah. There are people working on it, but it's execution. It's, you know, converting a billion people to direct benefit system. It's massive execution.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think the idea now is getting widely accepted. It's making it happen on the ground.
And as you say in the book, India has many strengths, but execution is not one of them.
That's right. They talk too much.
I won't accuse you of that. It's good talk. There's some fascinating quotes in your book, and I have to read a couple for the audience. I can't resist. This is talking now about the environment. And you say, Western concerns regarding the environment resemble a fat guy on a diet right after a massive dinner. The other one, which I found interesting also, is in the US, people drive miles and miles in a gas-guzzling SUV to camp in pristine, protected forest.
Drive down to the, you know, redwoods or something.
How do you explain these U.S. contradictions?
Well, I think that's part of this why the debate on global climate change is so difficult, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you look at the whole climate change issue, you know, if you look at the greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, we are at something like 430 parts per million, and before industrialization began, it was at about 280 parts per million. And all the current belief is that if you hit beyond 500 to 550 parts per million, then you get into this unsustainable global warming, temperature rises. But the reality is that means that 50% of the atmosphere has already been used up. And it's been used up essentially by the rich countries. So the poor countries rightly say that you guys went and, you know, consumed all this stuff and you filled it up with all this gas. Now you are telling us to control it. And that's the big political issue at places like Kyoto and Copenhagen discussions.
But you're not buying that. I mean, you're saying it's in India's interest.
No, I make the point that India and China and all developing countries should separate the two issues. There's an issue of what is an equitable global deal. In other words, who pays how much for what they have done? That's an argument you can have in an international conversation. And there you put down the fact who's done what. But notwithstanding that, it's in India's own strategic interest to address environment issues proactively, because there's no point making the same mistakes. So we should do what we have to do. At the same time, we should get a good deal in a global conversation.
Interesting. So another thing that may surprise the audience, I've got to also read this, you know, for you, just to be sure. If I understand correctly, the Indian Parliament passed a law, I'm moving to the next subject now, these might be called iceberg issues, or maybe beneath the surface, I didn't realize this, but you say the Indian Parliament passed a law that allowed the states to put, get this, sons and daughters who do not care for their parents in jail. How would you like that? And you really go on to point out that the government has completely washed its hands off of taking care of the elderly.
What? Yeah, so basically we don't have social... I mean, in the U.S., I think the whole system of social security came in the 1930s after the Depression and the need to create a program of social entitlements and so forth. So India has never had that, and only a very small fraction of people who work for government actually have a defined benefit social security scheme. So the rest of the people don't have any scheme, so that's why they're saying, you know, the children should look after them.
But have people actually been put in jail?
No, I don't think so. I think this is just government trying to show that they care so much that they, you know, pass laws like this.
But you're trying to say that the government has an obligation.
No, I think government has to put in. At the same time, and I've talked about it, that you have to design it well. Because what happened, I think, in the U.S., when social security was defined in the 1930s, they didn't really fully understand the consequences of a defined benefit scheme, this pay-as-you-go, right, all this stuff. And what happens then as the population begins to age, then the entitlements become huge. I mean, today the unfunded liabilities in this country for Social Security, Medicare, Mediclaim, all that, it runs into trillions of dollars. So I make the point that, you know, we should have a social insurance, but we should also think about the design of that, so that in the long term it doesn't become unsustainable. So a lot of what I say is actually say, look around us. Look at the challenges in other countries. Why do you want to repeat those things?
And then you constantly look at what could be seen as negatives, as to me positives, and one of them is this demographic dividend you talk about, that luckily India has a very young population, so it has the advantage, if it does things right, that it wouldn't get into the problems that, say, the U.S.
Exactly.
is going to be.
Yeah. I make this point that India is has this young population, and it's not just a young population, it's the demographic dividend, which means that the bulk of the people are of working age, and less young people and less old people, and therefore your dependency ratio is low, and therefore it's a time when you can have rapid economic growth. But you can only have that if you invest in the people. If people are healthy and they can, you know, they have skills, only this demographic dividend makes sense. And many of the things, policies you can do when you are young, should sustain you when you are old. So that's why the choices are very important now.
So one of the things you do also so well is that India is not just one monolithic entity. And you talk about the tremendous variation. And I was intrigued with this, those from India would know, Bimaru states, I love that term, which is Bihar, Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, and Uttar Pradesh. It's about 400 million people, roughly. And they have not participated in the green revolution and the white revolution in terms of dairy or the IT revolution. What's going to happen if the disparity keeps going?
That's the big enchilada, as they say, you know. India has two demographic dividends. You know, the south and the west is already starting aging. If you look at the southern state of Kerala, it is already at replacement fertility rates. Its birth rate is as low as a West European country, whereas UP is something three times that. So in the next 50 years, only 12.6% of the new babies born in India will be in the south. 50% will be in these four or five states where we have the most problems. So if we don't address that, then it'll be really much more chaotic, because you'll have massive migration, because there'll be no jobs. Right. And they'll go all over, and as it is, there's so much social tension, it'll only become worse.
One ray of hope is, you say, they could be the engine for the biofuels.
Yeah, I make the point that, you know, these regions didn't really have any economic engine ever, and perhaps the cellulosic biofuels, you know, not the stuff which replaces like corn, but, you know, stuff which is using bagasse or jatropha or switchgrass, those kind of things which can grow in arid regions, could potentially be... This is just a thought. I mean, just to be tested. But I'm just saying that they need some economic driver to get them out of that morass.
And if that doesn't happen, do you envision in 50 years, who knows, two Indias?
Well, you know, a lot of people have been predicting India's breakup for many years. That's not happening. But certainly, I think the tensions can be higher. Because today, for example, the per capita income of Goa, which is a very rich state, is four times the per capita income of Bihar, which is a very poor state. So if in the same, and the same problem in China. China also, if you look at the per capita income on the coastal regions versus inland China, the ratio is even more, I think, 5 to 1, 6 to 1. So if a country has such wide income disparities, it's bound to lead to tension.
So I was trying to look at the book and say, what does it not have? I mean, it has got everything. And finally, I came up with something it doesn't have, which is there's nothing on, it's hard to imagine India without thinking about Pakistan and China. And you say almost nothing about Pakistan. And maybe I figured that's because you don't want to write a 1,000-page book. But what's going to happen with the tension between, we just heard 2 days ago, the atrocities in Lahore. Maybe this is way beyond what you want to talk about.
I think it's right. I didn't touch too much on India's foreign policy or geopolitics, but I think it's an important point. I think you're right in saying that whatever I talk about, that if India is to develop for the next 50, 60 years with rapid growth, it can't do that in a neighborhood which is unstable. Because if you look at the U.S., it has the benefit of having, you know, Canada and Mexico on either side.
Right.
If you look at Europe, and after the Second World War, the Europeans said it's time to stop fighting with each other and they created the European Union. And therefore, India has to have good, stable, prosperous neighbors. And certainly what's happening today in places like Pakistan is very disturbing.
So it could be the
wild card.
So speaking about other countries, the comparison in everybody's mind is China. And to tease the audience and let them read the book, I mean, I love the foreword that Tom Friedman wrote. What's your own view of, I'm sure you asked this question, to compare China and India?
I think there are a lot of similarities. There are two countries with a billion population, which have been historically great powers, who fell on bad times and now coming back. And that's common to both. But India is very much a bottom-up economy with entrepreneurial drive. China is much more state capitalism driven from the top. India is a democracy. China is, you know, more authoritarian. And also, but most importantly, China is coming to the end of its demographic dividend. And India is beginning its demographic dividend. And that's the most fundamental structural difference. And the reason also because it's because of democracy. Because I think in the 1970s, late 70s, both China and India were under great global pressure to do something about their population. And China did something called the one-child policy, which gave them accelerated short, immediate benefits because their population growth rate dropped dramatically. So they got the demographic dividend in the last 30 years. India was both incapable and incompetent to do population control on a coercive basis. And the one time they tried, the government lost the election. So after that, they even changed the name of the department from family planning to family welfare, because no politician wanted to be associated with this stuff. And so India's population slowed down slower, but now it's going to reap the benefits. So the fact that China's population dividend is in the past and India's in the future, I think, is the biggest single strategic issue.
So before I open it up to the audience, I have to ask you, where are you going to take all this now? You've been on a whirlwind tour and interviewed a lot of people all over the place. Where
can I take a break?
You'll take a break?
Yeah, why can't I? Mean, I should. I mean, I've done
I feel
enough.
Sorry for the CEO then.
No, I won't go to the office. I'll do something else. No, what I meant is, I think a lot of these things have come out of my experience, because I not only do a private sector CEO, corporate job, I also participate hugely in some of these public policy issues and debates. So I hope to continue to contribute. A lot of the things I'm talking about in the book are actually projects on the ground, which I hope to support and make them happen.
Well, I'll just close and then open it up to the audience. The Economist, which is known to shred books to pieces, said some very nice things about your book. And that guy had read your book, I could tell. The one thing that they asked, which I think is a fascinating question, is that your belief is that ideas will help, right? I'm certainly hoping that politicians will read this and take it to heart, and others as well. But The Economist, if you read the review, says that actually your data shows that ideas change only after circumstances change. Is that a valid?
Yeah, it is. In that sense, it is. It's a very good point, because the first half of my book is about ideas that change because of circumstances, and the second half of my book is saying how we should use ideas to change circumstances. So that's a good point. But my point is, look, we lucked out and got to this happy position. Right. But let's not hope that luck will carry the next journey.
Right. And there's always a chance that just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean it can be done.
That's right.
Okay, so this has been a patient audience, and we are open to, I think, all kinds of questions.
Sure. Open season.
I call the hands and, yep.
Fascinating discussion, and then I have a question about manufacturing. My name is Gunjan Bagla, and I had the chance to visit Bharat Forge in Pune a couple of years ago, an amazing, very modern facility. But it employs only a few thousand people. And as I look at the largest companies in India, companies that employ more than 100,000 people, it's typically the IT service providers. Now, when you look at a country of 1 billion people, your industry, the IT business, probably employs less than 5 million, even if you count indirect jobs. And looking at this future for sure. India, it's part of the solution has to lie in manufacturing. And I'm wondering, what will it take to create companies in India that employ 100, 200,000 people?
Well, I think all the things that need for that to happen are actually the kind of challenges I talk about in my book. The first is you need infrastructure, because in manufacturing, it's about moving real stuff. It's physical movement of goods. And you know, you need good roads and good ports if you want to send something out or even from one part of the country. So you need that. The second is you need single markets so that you can manufacture in one place and sell somewhere else. The third is you need a skilled population, because I think one of the big differences in China and India is China has almost full literacy, whereas India does not. And if people don't have basic skills, they can't read, they can't write, it's very difficult to, you know, involve them in a industrial situation if they have machines and all that. But most importantly, it also needs labor reforms. And what has happened in India is that labor laws are so stultifying that entrepreneurs would rather automate the factories than hire people, which is why you have this high-tech manufacturing with low employment. So you have this curious paradox where a country with the biggest labor force invests in labor-saving devices. So the labor reforms have to be done to bring in a lot of, to incentivize entrepreneurs to create jobs and at the same time create protection for employees. So there are a lot of these, you know, collateral things that have to be done to really create an industrial base. And I agree with you completely that, you know, the whole IT and BPO industry employs less than 2 million people. So while it creates great visibility globally and it earns foreign exchange, it's certainly not the solution for India's employment challenges.
Yes?
As Enron had a profound effect in the U.S. and triggered SOX, the scandal at Satyam, how do you think that's going to affect Indian corporate governance and controls and the like?
Well, I think certainly people are going to, and they're doing that, look at whatever were the reasons for that whole episode and see what are the institutional reforms that are required to do that. But in some sense also, I think it raises questions of how the company's ecosystem function, right? Because, you know, there was an independent board, there was an audit committee, there was an international auditor. So, and that really makes it even more perplexing that in that environment, how that functioned. So I think they will definitely, there is a look being done on all aspects of our transparency requirements, Securities Act, corporate governance standards to make changes. But I think it's more than that. Ultimately, it's also how did a company, because, you know, I think India does have a reasonable infrastructure for these, but in spite of that, it failed in this situation. So that's what is disconcerting. But I think the good news is the government moved in very quickly. It appointed a new board to the company. The board has quickly put this company up for sale. It's, in fact, this week, the sale process is going on. So I think in that sense, at least the reaction has been very swift.
On this side, yes, Mr. Chairman.
India thrives on small business, mom-and-pop operations, you know. That's why it's different from the rest of the world. You visit your favorite tailor, you go to your favorite sweet shop. Certain towns are known for certain items which are available. And I think a very high percentage of India is small business enterprise, mom-and-pop operations. What is the future? Is corporate India going to drive out small businesses and make it more like the rest of the world? We enjoy India because it's different.
Well, I think I don't think they'll drive them out. Certainly, there will be more organized supply chain and retail which will come in. That's also important because India's supply chain is completely dysfunctional. And 30 to 40% of the produce goes to waste because you don't have a supply chain, you don't have a food chain, you don't have a cold chain. And you know things are rotting in the open air and all that. So you need to really have world-class supply chains. So that's required. And I feel that it will ultimately come into coexistence. I mean, for example, there were the same worries when you know we had the global restaurant chains coming. You know, they said, you know, if McDonald's comes and Kentucky Fried Chicken comes, then people will stop eating dosas or whatever. But that didn't happen. In fact, there are more Indian small restaurants than these chains. So I think there's enough resilience in the Indian small entrepreneur to make it even when big guys come in.
In front here.
If one of the problems with India is the fact that you haven't got an educated population, what is India doing to ensure that the young people are getting educated or will get educated?
Well, I think that's a very important issue. And obviously India is one of its biggest strategic mistakes was not educating its young people. And there are many schools of thought as to why that happened. One reason is that the money was spent on higher education instead of primary education. The second reason is that Hinduism was an oral tradition, and therefore, unlike Christianity and other religions where you had to learn the script to read the Bible, in Hinduism you could just listen to the stories, and therefore you didn't have to be educated. The third reason is the caste system, that the upper caste didn't want the lower caste to have education because they felt then they would rise. And the fourth was rural landlords didn't want their laborers to get educated because then they would demand more wages. So there are a whole set of social reasons for that. But I think that has changed now. I think people want education. I think the poor are very keen on education. They're seeing the economic consequences of lack of education. We talked about how they're encouraging private schools. And while the state school system is still dysfunctional, there's a huge effort to improve it. You know, we now have a tax on our taxes. Only for education. We pay 3% tax on our taxes. So India's annual tax collection is about $100 billion. So we collect about $3 billion a year only for primary education. So there are a lot of things happening on the ground. And it's muddling along. But I do believe in the next 10, 15 years, this thing is going to get licked. This problem is going to get solved. There's just too much of focus on this. And there are a lot of great NGOs and private entrepreneurs all trying to fix this problem.
Let's go way back there.
First of all, Nandan, thanks for coming. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much. On the geopolitical item, no matter what one might feel or think or describe about the Bush administration, there appears in their last few months, maybe the last year, to have been a deal cut with your prime minister on the strategic level, which by definition would include nuclear weapons and nuclear non-proliferation, or the opposite.
Not weapons, only nuclear power.
Can you explain and let us know?
Yeah, basically India signed an agreement with the US and with the other countries in the Indian International Atomic Energy Area for the transfer of peaceful nuclear energy. So it's only for power, because given all these issues of global warming, it's to increase the proportion of energy in India from nuclear power plants. So it's nothing to do with military uses. It's only for civilian use for nuclear energy, and all those places will be under international safeguards.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, there.
Nandan, thank you. And Vijay, some good questions. My name is Sunny. I'm a student at UCLA Anderson. My question to Nandan is on how would, an entrepreneur in the IT services and BPO space now should focus based on the current economic conditions in the US and also increasing regulations and outsourcing. if a new entrepreneur had to come into this space, what would be your best way to get into this?
Well, I think that certainly the current global climate is very challenging, and I think it will be like that for some time, even as we figure out how this world is going to get growth back going. But I think that there are many, many business opportunities today in IT world. For example, in India, one of the hottest areas is mobile phones. And there are so many startups who are providing different kinds of value-added services around mobiles, because you have a population now of 300 million mobile phones. Similarly, there's a huge, I think, opportunities in new computing models like software as a service, utility computing, you know, cloud computing. All these new models are emerging, and I think there's enough opportunities for services around that.
Yes, front here.
Hi, Mr. Nilekani. I just wanted to say that you're a great source of inspiration to a lot of youth in India. My question was, do you have any words of advice to young entrepreneurs in India?
Yeah, deferred gratification.
There's a question back there.
Hi, my name is Jagdish Joshi. I just had a quick question. Regarding the transparency with the Swiss laws for banking, there is a lot of quotes about significant amount of wealth which is residing in Switzerland. What are your thoughts on how that should be handled, you know, and gotten back?
No, I think certainly we should have full transparency if there are people who have assets outside the country by violating laws or by evading taxes, certainly we should have that information.
Any other questions? Yes, in front here.
Yeah,
it's coming.
Hello there. I wanted to ask about these horizontal cracks that you mentioned in your book and how it's going to impact the opportunities of young women in India from traditional roles versus the opportunities that you see in New India.
Well, I think that it varies from region to region. I think in some parts, I think women have a lot more equality and a lot more access to opportunity than other parts. I think it's changing. That the number of women in the workforce is going up. The number of women in politics is going up. For example, in our not at so much the parliament level, but at the level of local self-governments, there are millions of women who are elected to local body because there's a law which says that a proportion of the elected representatives must be women. So there are a lot of these kind of things happening. But there are also big challenges. I mean, you know, female infanticide still is a challenge in many parts of India. The male-female birth ratio is not what it should be because of that. So it's a mixed bag. I think there are parts where there's lots happening. There are parts which are still very depressing.
Maybe one or two more questions. Way back there.
The parliamentary elections in India are about to begin. I'm wondering first if you would care to venture a guess as to the outcome of the election. And secondly, once a prime minister, a new government is in place, what are the top two or three priorities that you would tell the prime minister that he must do within the first year or so?
You know, predicting the Indian election is as difficult as predicting when this economic crisis will get over. But I'll take a shot at it. I think, it's obviously going to be a coalition. And my own sense is that perhaps a Congress-led coalition today has a slight upper chance. I mean, that's just a personal view. It's nothing based on some great empirical stuff. But if you were to say what are the priorities, one is clearly the economic recovery. Because while India has been affected by this whole thing because of many reasons, but fortunately, its core economy doesn't have some of the structural imbalances that we have elsewhere. So I think India has the potential to quickly do a number of things, both short-term and long-term, to get the economy back on track. So that would be the number one challenge, because politically, that's a huge challenge because of job losses and so forth. The second thing is what we talked about is reinforcing the effort to get the best out of our demographic dividend, which is redouble efforts on education, job creation, on vocational skills, anything that can create jobs for people. That would be the second big thing. And probably the third big thing is, you know, get the infrastructure going, which is also related. So I think, but I think getting the economy going will probably be the biggest challenge for the new government, because in the last few months, because of the elections, the economy is not necessarily getting all the attention it deserves.
One or two more? Yes, back there, right next to you.
Thank you. Can microcredit be part of a global strategy?
I'm sorry?
Can microcredit be part of a global strategy?
Part of a global strategy for whom?
Nationwide, in terms of developing a small...
No, certainly business. Microcredit is very important, because anything which does some kind of financial inclusion, where people who didn't have access to banking and financial services can now have access, will improve their lives, because they'll have ways to save money, they'll have ways to borrow money, they'll have ways to spend money, and so on. So anything which extends the reach of formal financial products to the poor is important. It's not the only thing to be solved, but it's certainly a very big part of the solution.
Maybe one more, or many hands here, maybe two more. Right in the front here.
Mobile system, you mean cell phones?
Yes.
As in the maker of phones, or?
Yes.
Well, I think broadly there are three or four very popular phones. There's Nokia, there's Samsung, there's Motorola, and of course Qualcomm-based devices for the CDMA guys.
One last question.
And Sony Ericsson also.
Yes, in front here.
Okay. I haven't read the book yet.
That's fine. I forgive you.
I've heard you make the contrast between India and China, the Chinese have been better at execution. So what can India draw from the Chinese experience in terms of that?
Well, you know, I think there are a number of things. One is the will to do it, because I think the Chinese, once they make up their mind, they do it. The second is the financing. I think the financing in India for infrastructure is a small fraction of the China. You know, China's GDP is about, say, 2.5 to 3 trillion, and they spend 10% of GDP on infrastructure. India's GDP is 1 trillion, and we spend maybe 3-4% of GDP on infrastructure. So there's a dramatic difference in the spends. And the third is, and this is where, you know, weak project management. You know, they don't have good project management. And the fourth is that it's very difficult to build, because like here, we have all this not in my backyard kind of thing, where everybody wants the road, but not in, you know, behind them. Everybody wants the wind, you know, sort of the solar plant, but not next to them. So there's a lot of those fights which impede the progress of infrastructure.
Great. So any last words for us, Nandan?
Well, great. I really find you know, it's important to understand India in the context of other countries' development, because the Western civilizations grew at an average of 2-2.5% per year for 200 years. So what they did in over 200 years, India will have to do in 60 years, with a population that is probably 10 times the size, with full democracy, and today's media. So it's much, you know, it's much more complex.
Well, thanks for your tremendous contribution.
Thank you.
Allowed Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Allowed theme composed by Larry Karish.